You're listening to Bedroom Beethovens, where notable music makers break down stories accompanied by songs and melodies documenting growth through their 10,000-hour journey. And me? Well, my name is Cello, your host.
I am a bedroom Beethoven.
Hey, people of Earth, welcome to episode 129 of the podcast. My guest this week is...
Yeah, hey, my name is Tyler Duncan, and I am a producer, a composer, record maker, studio rat. Maybe studio rat's the term.
Antoine Stanley, I am a singer, songwriter, performer, and... I love what I do.
A rocket in a crowded room, looking to light the fuse. A 33 or 45, watching the waxing night. So hold on, dim the lights and let them bring off. Buckle up, we're set for
pretty crazy series of events leading up to the conversation in present day we're about to have on this episode. You take two Michigan-bred musicians who were drawn into each other's orbit 10 years ago through a web of friends and collaborators, one of those webs known as Wolfpack. Eventually, their admiration of each other's gifts led them to try getting together in an Ann Arbor backyard with a guitar, their voice memo apps, and they just wanted to see if anything magical would happen, and guess what? Something magical did happen. So fast forward Grammy nominations, playing the biggest venues in the world, and appearing on national television. It's funny that they feel like right now they're just getting started. Their new album, Ascension, just successfully got campaigned on Kickstarter, and the tunes will be headed your way soon, both physically and digitally. Before we get to the goods, though, I would like to thank my Patreons, because without them, this podcast wouldn't be possible without their support. And if you would like to join them, just head on over to patreon.com/bedroombeethovens. And if you'd like more info, just check the website bedroombeethovens.com. I really appreciate the love everyone is showing. And feel free to connect with me on social media, Twitter, and Instagram. Or you can shoot me an email. More importantly, these podcasts wouldn't even be created if it wasn't for the generosity of my guests like Antoine and Tyler to give up time in their day. So without further ado, let's get it. And it's a small world, Tyler, because Charlene Kay was on the podcast not too long ago. I don't know if are you familiar?
Yeah. No way.
So you both know we're good. Yeah, yeah, that whole Ann Arbor music scene with you know, Darren Criss and Michelle Shamuel and Joe Dart and all that. So from the stories that she told me, I hear at the Michigan Theater or the Blind Pig or Potbelly or whatever venue, like you guys were like the real last mega talented group of OM students to like really make a mark on the music world.
Oh, whoa, that.
Well, I mean, I hope not the last. Jeez, that would be a sad. But yeah, we definitely like, I feel like there was a really sort of special, there was a special time in Ann Arbor, and I just happened to be at the perfect age at that time with all these incredible musicians and artists. And yeah, so that time was very like fruitful, and it's amazing to look back and think of how many amazing careers have come out of Ann Arbor and sort of surrounding areas at that time, and connected through the U of M or other ways. But like, yeah, no, it was an incredible time. And Charlene and Michelle, and like, I mean, it was bumping, you know, 2008 in Ann Arbor, the music scene was really bumping. It was so much fun. I really miss that.
Yeah. Of course, no disrespect to the future grads of UM. It just, like you said, it just seemed like 12 years ago or however long ago, it was special. Because, I mean, if I take a name and I put it in YouTube, the music varies so much from artist to artist, and you guys have all carved your own lane. It was a amalgamism that gravitated towards each other. And of course, Tyler, I can point out you're Grammy nominated. Antoine, you have numerous awards. But when it comes down to it, if you can produce pop music and then pivot to Americana folk and then classical Baroque and then rock and then techno funk, it's like you're able to compartmentalize your talent and apply it to where you need it.
Yeah. I mean, if you're enough of a nerd, you know, about music, basically is what it comes down to. If you love it and are obsessive enough, you know, all those things are really fun. You know, it's fun to stretch and keep being unfamiliar, you know, with some new project and just forcing yourself to expand to meet the demands of the thing. It's a blast, you know?
And if we're talking, I guess the last year or so, Antoine, I'll mm-hmm. direct this towards you. The pandemic related, the ability to sit and rest and wait and be, as you say, is not a skill that comes easy to most, but the pandemic has almost forced musicians to sit still for a year. How did you deal with it? Were there any struggles or self-doubt start to creep in?
Yeah, I mean, I think as an artist, you know, you do, you know, when you're not able to freely go and do what it is that you feel called to do, I do think that, you know, some, you know, doubt can kind of sit in, and especially when you see that your peers are not able to do, you know, what they want to do as well. Yeah, you can feel a certain way. But I think, you know, you go in those moments, you can do so much. You can go and listen to some, you know, some records, dig up some records that you love. You can, through the use of technology, you know, get on and, you know, chat with a friend and see what they're doing and, you know, seeing how, you know, they're keeping themselves up. And then of course you can always, you know, pick up that pen and paper or, you know, whip out that, that notebook and start writing. And so that's where I've kind of concentrated, you know, some of my efforts, you know, throughout this pandemic is the music. It's really interesting how music just kind of comes to the forefront of how powerful it is, especially in times like these, where you can go back as a musician or whatever art, you know, that you have, you're able to kind of go, you know, back to it. Even if it is like an abridged version of it, you can, you know, attach yourself, you know, to it, even though you're not in front of that audience that you're maybe used to.
I was scared personally because I know how collaborative you both are. I mean, there's Groove Spoon, there's Ann Street Soul, there's Wolfpick, there's Dixon Jane. With Tyler, there's Ella Riot, S/He. You're playing bagpipes with Futura. There's Angry Man. It's clear that this is what you guys want to do. You just want to be a part of music. There's a lot of musical avenues you both have explored. I was getting a little worried that like these musicians that love to collaborate and they're not able to go to venues, they're not able to network, they're not able to see their friends, that it was going to be a scary time, but you guys persevered. Yeah, thank God.
Yeah, it's been rough, like you said, but you find ways to either cope or just to deal with you know, those moments.
Had one of those years. Believe me when I tell you, believe nothing people tell you. Ho, say I will not sit and weep. It's the pleasure time. It's dance week.
Yeah. I don't think we're completely out of the woods, but you know, I feel grateful to have had an opportunity to do the musical things that I have done in the time that we've been in our hideaways.
Well, if I'm going back, if this is for me, I like to play like the alternate timeline game. Now, Antoine, if you had won the Motown BET talent search, you would have been signed to Andre Harrell's Motown record era. You would have been on the same label as Boyz II Men before you even hit middle school, right?
Oh, wow. Oh, you took it way back. Oh, man, we're talking about the BET Motown talent search. Wow. Yeah. I think out of 25,000 contestants, I somehow wound up as one of the 10 finalists on the show. And this was, I believe it was 96, and I was singing a gospel tune. And I think it was by Yolanda Adams, and it was called Just a Prayer Away. And it was crazy because I had gotten choked up and I actually didn't finish. I didn't finish the song, but I up until that, the live presentation, which aired on BET, I worked so hard and, you know, I had gone through all of the auditions and things of that sort. And so even though I didn't complete the entire performance on the live show, at the very end of the show, before Andre Harrell, who was the president of Motown Records at that time, offered me a demo development contract.
I think what's important to note is Harrell served as the CEO for under 2 years. He left the company after receiving bad publicity for being inefficient. This was before the Brian McKnights and the Erykah Badus were a part of that label. So it's a great opportunity of 20,000 people to place in the top 10. But in the end, it might have been a bullet dodged. Because I think at 9 years old, he'd been like, oh, yeah, where's the dotted line? Yeah. And he said at the finale of that talent show that, like, I'm looking to resurrect soul music. I'm looking for soul singers, singers that remind you of Aretha, singers that remind you of Marvin Gaye, singers that remind you of grassroots voices filled with joy, hope, and pain like Bill Withers. And that's that's a tall order. And then I looked at the winner of that competition, and it was a woman,
Lola,
who has 78 Twitter followers now and 200 Facebook fans. And it's crazy. You know, I go back and it's like, you know, did The Voice help Michelle Samuel as much as we thought? Do these competitions and shows really catapult you to where you need to be? Or is it just TV ratings and empty promises? So I don't want to take away that accomplishment. That's amazing, Antoine, but it might have been a bullet dodge for your career.
You know, That's something I never really thought about it that way, but you make a really, really interesting point. And yeah, it could very well have been. I mean, I was really young at that time, and the winner of that show, I'm not sure what age, not that it really, really matters, but it was at a very early stage in my life. And so I think even if I had won and was giving a contract, I'm not really sure where I would be. But yeah, that is a very interesting point. And you know, she was a fantastic, she was an amazing talent, the lady who won that competition. And it is, although it is very, like, it's a little jarring to see nowadays. You can go and find an artist who, you know, was really amazing and is still amazing, but you know, don't have the recognition that they probably should have. And that, you know, that just happens across the board. You know, I think talent competitions, you know, that there's a whole story to that.
And Tyler, I think Ella Riot was your effort to do music full time as a career.
For, oh gosh, what, 6 years? You know, Mitre Disco, Ella Riot, same band. We just changed our name at the end for like a year, which, you know, was a long-term based decision, and now we're all like, damn. if we only knew we only had a year left, we would have kept Mitre Disco. But yeah, that was all I did for those kind of formative post-college years. Just like hit the ground running right after we graduated. It felt like we graduated and just got on the bus and left town and started touring. Like, that was basically my experience. And then we had no idea what we were doing. So it was like not just touring, it was like the most trial and error version of touring possible, you know, right out the gate. So yeah, Ella Riot was where I sort of cut my teeth.
But it was kind of calculated with what you wanted to get out of that, because you guys took a very business oriented approach to it. If you wanted it to be full time as your career, I remember, and this is like the biggest compliment I could afford you, is I remember you referring to the music as Dance Think. Because if you look at old dance records like Strafe Set It Off or whatever, you can't find the vinyl for those old house and dance records from the 80s, because the thought process was, well, only the DJ should have the vinyl, because you're gonna listen to dance records at the clubs. You're not going to go home and wake up with your morning coffee and throw on dance or house music. Mm-hmm. Tunes that sounded just as good on the dance floor as they did through your headphones. It's a novel concept that seems obvious, but a lot of people didn't take that route until maybe a few years ago. I feel like you're kind of ahead of the curve.
That's nice. That's nice to say. I mean, we really just, it was a natural thing, because we just were like, well, what is this? What are we trying to do? And Bob, the guitar player, was like, I feel like and he wasn't even trying to say it as like a thing we should share publicly. He was just like, I feel like this is like dance think music. It's like, it's kind of both. It's like music, you know, music majors, kind of people who are obsessy about like the sort of finer details of composition and all the various things that, you know, a music major might get into. But we were like focusing that passion into like a dance music context. And so the term just was like, well, shit, that is kind of it. That's what we're doing. Let's call it that. Let's call it the thing. And Yeah, you know, it's funny. I don't know. I never have thought about whether or not El Riot or Mighty Disco was like ahead of the curve or not in that way. But like, you know, I feel like the concept of dance think certainly, like, in my mind, always stretched well beyond like what we did. I always felt like, you know, like Latin jazz or Afro-Cuban music or all this stuff is so engaging and so musically dense and complex and beautiful. And it's like for the dance floor, but it's also like equally compelling. It just sort of felt like the term, we didn't have a term, so we needed one. And there it was. It was kind of like, couldn't think of another way to describe it, really, you know?
And how do you get a guy like Mike Saunders, who sound engineered Mick Jagger and David Bowie and Depeche Mode and The Cure, to mix a record put out essentially by a college band?
Oh, man, you've done your homework. This is so, like, who even knows about Mark Saunders and Mighty Disco? I was taught by my parents, like, you know, if you want to get in touch with somebody, open the phone book and find their number and call them, and you never know. And that's basically what it was. I was just like impressed by his mixing and just did everything I could to figure out how to get a hold of him. And we ended up getting a hold of his project manager and a guy named Ollie Hammett. And sort of just being tenacious with the communication. And then we actually developed a relationship with Ollie and Mark, and we signed a production deal with them, and they were trying to help us sort of just get opportunities and gigs in the industry, and sort of took us under wing and Mark. And Ollie ended up actually working with and managing Devin Kerr for a number of years, who masters a lot of the stuff that a lot of people in the scene, our little Michigan scene, you know, we hired Devin to master, but he and Ollie worked together for years. And then Ollie manages an artist named Teddy Geiger. And then Theo Katzman and I did work for Teddy. Anyway, like, ended up actually becoming the beginning of like a longstanding sort of relationship on that worked its way through the network. So yeah, it ended up funny being like, here we were, this college band who were really, we were taking it seriously and working our asses off. And like, when we sent the music to Ollie, he was like, wow, this is like very impressive. Like, y'all are doing this like in your bedrooms. Like, wow, let's definitely check this out. And then, you know, Mark liked it enough to be down to mix it. And we learned a ton. I mean, I learned so much in working with Mark, you know, on that record, like just seeing his work process and how he looked at arranging and producing and all that stuff. It was like a very formative experience. And even though maybe the record, well, certainly the record didn't go platinum, but like, the education from it was invaluable for me. Had a lot of opportunities that kind of almost happened through it. You know, it's funny how that works. You know, you hope for 1%, but we had all sorts of things in the works that just never panned out, but like, had a few more of them worked out, we would have a lot more visible sort of history with Mark Saunders. But as it stands, we got some cool gigs. We got some cool TV stuff. He mixed several of the tracks on the record and we learned a ton, and those tracks sound great. And, It was awesome. But yeah, it was ultimately just me trying to like find a way to get in touch with him and kind of working my way through the internet and different people. I could figure out a way to get a hold of them, and ended up finding Ollie. And then that took us to Mark. And then we went to New York and spent this time with Mark. And yeah, you know, I think my parents were right in this instance of saying, get the phone book out, you know, it's just figure it out. Get a hold of somebody, see what happens.
That's what I did. I just went to your contact page and
that's what you did.
Essentially exactly. The same thing. So
that's what you did.
It's tried and true.
It is. And even sometimes people who seem like really high up, they aren't unreachable, you know, and if they like your stuff, then things can happen.
Well, because the band was so business oriented, I make, you know, some of the breakups or the group changes, because you were either fresh graduates, I don't know if people were thinking about corporate jobs or settling down with their significant others, picket fence, two dogs and a kid, whatever it is. But when you give 110% and you put so much into music, you can't do much else with your life. And it's hard to know what you want out of life when you're in your early 20s.
Yeah.
So now that you're in your 30s, you know, I can ask you this. What did you want out of life when El Riot broke up? And did you achieve everything you wanted to up until this point?
That's a, hit me with the heavy questions. You know what's funny is my journey so far in my musical life, kind of post a certain time in my 20s, has been this like slow kind of arc back to something that I can now see was like the case when I was a child. But I had to sort of try a million things to figure it out. So at the time, like Ella Riot, I thought I wanted to be in a band, touring the world, playing shows, being one of the cool people that I saw in airports with like a guitar case who was like, didn't know what city they were in. That was like the coolest person in the world to me. And I wanted to be that person. Through the years of trying so many different versions of touring and making projects and collaborating and stuff, what I kind of learned was, and this was during the band, I was like, wow, actually my favorite part is when we make the record. I really like that part. And then I'm kind of starting to get a little tired of the shows and the booking and the merch and the all the other stuff. I could kind of take or leave that, but the records, I get really excited about making another one. And then I kind of realized like, man, what if I just, maybe I should just do that part. Is that possible? And so then it's been this journey of like, well, what does it look like to just make the records and not worry as much about the shows? And that's been kind of the arc I've been on. And now it's like, oh, turns out I just really like composing music and I like recording it. And so if I'm doing that, I'm pretty happy. And if I don't do that, I get sad. And so now that's what I do. I get to compose music in the studio and collaborate with incredible people like Antoine, you know, and make stuff that we feel like matters and we believe in and are putting our like our hearts and souls into. And it's writing music in a studio. And, you know, Ella Riot was obviously, it was like a very big step in trying a million things to sort of come to this clarity of like, oh, it's kind of simple for me, but it wasn't a simple process coming to that realization. You know, I had to trial and error for 10 years to really get there.
And now it's a career fulfilled prophecy. So it's good. And
so far.
And Antoine, we have to catch up on your timeline now. Upon a time you were on NBC's The Queen Latifah Show. Antoine, what is your mother's name?
Yeah. So my mother's name is Khadijah, but she goes by KK.
And that was, and Queen Latifah's character's name on Living Single was this.
You're good.
You can't
man.
Write
You're
it up. This, it's all part of God's plans. Yes, I'm trying to tell you.
I love it, man. So yeah, on the show, Queen Latifah on, was it Living Single? Yeah.
Yeah.
Khadijah. So I think they pronounced it Khadijah, but my mom's name is pronounced Khadijah. And that's too funny how, we just wound up, you know, just crossing paths. And here I'm on the show. And of course, the Queen Latifah show. But yeah, that was really odd and interesting. And like, whoa, okay, here we are.
it's quite the coincidence. Yeah. And you were born in 87, correct?
Yes. Yep. Late 80s baby.
Your mom was born in 71.
Yes. Yes. She was born in 71.
So she was a fairly young mom.
Oh, fairly. She was. Yeah. My mom, she had me at a very young age. She was 15. Can you believe that?
Wow.
That's fascinating.
Very,
wow.
Very hard to believe, but. Yeah, she was a really young mother. And, you know, the bond that we have is such an unbreakable bond. And I think because, you know, she had me at such an early age and was trying to figure out so many nuances within her life at that time, I think that's probably what contributes to the strength of the relationship that we have. I have a younger brother as well. He's 4 years younger than I am, like how our birthdays lay. But anyhow, we all have a really good bond. But I grew up in a single parent home, and I was born and raised in Flint, Michigan. And but yeah, going back to what you were saying, yeah, she had me at a very young age. So the struggle was real at the very beginning. For her, but for me as well. But you know, she's been one of the, if not the main constant in my life that has, helped me, you know, realize that there is nothing that you cannot do if you set your mind to it.
So it makes sense that things like faith and education are so important, because those are the things that ensure that you, A, grow up to be a respectable young man, and two, that you have a future with career and things to fall back on. And she emphasized those things.
Well, you know, I try to, you know, be that type of human being. And, whatever I do in my life, I'm always trying to be exemplary of those values that, she has instilled into, my brother and me. And I feel lucky to have grown up in that type of household. It was a single parent household, like I said, but it was so rich in love and care and faith that, I don't really think so much about it anymore. It's just like, I had one, but we got it done.
And your brother that you mentioned, I don't want to mispronounce his name. Is it Kalon?
Yeah, you got it.
So I find it fascinating, because you've said in past interviews that you began singing, or your family discovered that you were able to sing around three, which had to have been around the time that he was kind of born. He was so right around the time that we discovered that little Antoine had singing chops. he followed in your footsteps. He went to Central High School. He went to UM, but he also went into the Navy, and he became an EMT. Yes. How do you think that happens? Like, there's two brothers, same upbringing, same location, Flint, Michigan, but two radically different paths.
Oh man, you're too good. I like, have you already spoken to one of the family members? I mean, you've got it. No man, I think I always go back to my mother. My mother is the common denominator for for a lot of that. So just to kind of give you a little bit of background, or a little bit more background, music has always been a huge part of my life. As you already know, my mom, she would often sing around the house, and, being raised in a church, of course, had a huge deal to do with my musical journey. And but it wasn't just me. My brother, he was also into it as well. I mean, he was also into athletics, and, could just do pretty much everything, while, I would always just be in a room, just humming and doing the total opposite. But I sang my first song when I was 3 years old. Yeah. And while sitting, I was sitting at a little Tykes table in the kitchen. And my mom, she started singing Amazing Grace. And not long after, I suddenly broke out into my own version, and she went crazy and, started calling everybody she knew to tell them that I could sing. And at the time, I didn't really understand, but it definitely proved to be a pivotal moment for me. And eventually I would go on and make my public singing debut at my great grandmother's birthday party. And, so that kind of kicked things off. And before I knew it, the stages started to get bigger. The crowd started to get larger, and I, began traveling more and more. And when my brother was born, he was, kind of born into that. It's like the engine had started, and then, you go and you go to the next stop, and then the next stop. Well, so he was, one of those first stops. And in addition to him being highly athletic, he also, was very talented musically too. So he would learn a lot of he would always see me, just kind of humming and maybe writing some things here and there. I was more into just singing at that time, not as much songwriting. So that came a little later. And I'm still growing into that. And that's been a really, really cool experience that has really just kind of opened so much more for me. But yeah, my brother, he was, he came into that eventually, and, he can sing and write as well. So
very cool, man. I'm glad to see everyone kind of come out of their shells into their 30s, really taking charge of their destiny. Matt Altruda, who worked as a promoter for Ella Riot, recently told me that like a story, back in the day when you guys were college students, that Michelle Shamuel used to want to perform on stage with sunglasses and a hoodie. And it's like, you have all these young kids that are so introverted, but talented at the same time. And it's just kind of fascinating to kind of watch the growth and see where you guys are now. I actually talked to Matt the other week. Tyler, he called you one of the greatest musicians on planet Earth. So I thought I'd pass that along.
I'd agree. Jeez, I'd agree.
Come on.
I'd agree. Oh, come on, man. So talented.
What were you Grammy nominated for? I know there was a big push for your work with Kittle & Co.
Yes, that was a track from the Kittle record.
Oh, okay. Well, let me ask you, now you got kind of like some inside track knowledge. In 2019, the winner for the best engineered album had 16 engineers in the credit. Beck wins for Colors. 16 engineers get Grammys. Uh-huh. Is that necessary? Do you need 16 engineers?
Oh, man. You know what that is? I would guess. I don't know anything about that process. I'm just guessing that a lot of people recorded a lot of different parts in different parts of the world. And then there was like a main hub. And so, you know, you have an engineer and their assistant in one studio in Nashville. Someone recorded the woodwinds in this place and wherever. And then, you know, the bass and drums were recorded here. Let's say you have an engineer and assistant engineer in every studio, 8 studios for like a big track, you know, that makes sense. Ultimately, you got to put them all on there. So that would be my guess. I doubt that there are 16 engineers in the same studio at the same time. I've never seen that before. That would be something.
If I asked you to stop Beck, could you execute that? Could you take him down? Tyler Duncan versus Beck in a versus. Can someone make that happen? he's won 3 times in the last 6 years. And there's a lot of cooks in the kitchen. I'm going to need you to put a stop to him.
Well, you know, I mean, even though we didn't win, my takeaway was that we tied for second with John Williams and I can't remember Terrence Blanchard won. Mm. We tied for second with John Williams is what I like to think of it as. So pretty good.
And Antoine, if I can highlight your musical prowess, when you landed on Colbert, John Batiste is playing with you and you don't even have an in-ear monitor. You're doing what less than 3% of musical guests on SNL can do, just natural singing. And after appearing on Colbert, you played a place in town called the Beat Kitchen that only holds 250 people. So to go from like selling out MSG to about that in 3 years, meteoric rise. Oh, that's crazy. Man. So I tip my hat off to you.
Wow, man. Well, it's, you know, it's, I credit, you know, the higher force. All praises to the GOD for the gift. And then of course, being surrounded by a great team. It's been a lot that's happened in the last really decade that has really just been something that was totally unexpected. But like I said, I'm extremely grateful to have had the chance to use the gift more and more, and to be surrounded by people like Tyler, who I've been able to just kind of sharpen my sword with. And yeah, here I am. So I appreciate that, man.
And I'm all in, man. My first and only time ever participating in a Q Crates crowdfund was that white 12-inch vinyl, the Wolf Vault #1, featuring all your features. I got that. I was blown away. Man. I've never participated in a Kickstarter either, but I'm going to get that vinyl too. Yeah. I'm going to do that.
Amazing.
I'm going to put my money where my mouth is. And the Wolfpack Thrill of the Arts, both of you contributed to that. It was also a Kickstarter album. A vinyl copy of that just sold for shy of $300 on Discogs.
What?
I'm not saying that you should back Ascension because it might be worth $300 someday, but I'm also not telling you that it could be worth $300 someday. So
what a way to plug.
When you finally find out about Tyler and Antoine, it might be too late for your wallet. I'm just saying.
You know what you were saying about Wolfpack's Ascension, and then when you were mentioning like The Voice and all these competitions, I was thinking about how like I've, you know, watching the Wolfpack Ascension, you know, over the last few years has been such the lesson I've taken from it, and I've really taken to heart is like the best way to grow is to just do your thing and let people come to that, as opposed to like hoping to like get a shortcut by, you know, essentially latching on to someone else's thing, which is what The Voice or American Idol ultimately is. You're kind of giving yourself to their brand and to their vision and to their mission, whatever it may be. And you're hoping that you get to sort of bypass a bunch of rungs on the ladder. But oftentimes it means you just climb someone else's ladder. And then when you want to get on your ladder, you have to start still at the first one. Yeah. And so almost it's like maybe you're better off just spending that time doing the thing that you love, that you want to do for the rest of your life. And then after 10 years, which is like, we forget, Wolfpack has been around for a while. They didn't go to MSG, you know, and I say they, including Antoine, of course, but like I wasn't at MSG. So, you know, I'm saying they, but you know, they didn't go there in a year. You know, it was like 10 years of just doing the thing that Wolfpack now is known for, but it wasn't about trying to skip ladders. And so I've from afar, not so much afar, obviously I'm kind of close to Wolfpack, but like I've been watching that and just being like, oh, there's such an amazing lesson here, because I've worked very closely with, okay, obviously I've worked closely with Wolfpack and Antoine and Theo and Joey and Jack and Woody and Joe, like a ton. And I also worked with Michelle, and I've also like done gigs with Josh Davis and Leith El-Sadi and all these people who got these sort of big spikes from TV. And it's just been interesting to see, oh, the thing that works is when people find you for what you do and then they stick with you. And then over 10 years, that turns into something like that's the, you know, it's been a really cool, a revelatory thing to witness in real time, you know, just by virtue of being so close to all the people in Wolfpack. So
it's
interesting that you
I would
up.
Agree with everything Tyler said, but I have to interject because we can never allow Tyler to under or downplay his prowess in like the Ann Arbor music scene, and just how, like, I mean, come on, Tyler has definitely been a part of all of that, and I know that he says Wolfpack and it's more like them, they, but man, Tyler has definitely been one of those pieces of glue that kind of brings so many of us together. And yeah, I just can't, you know, I don't want that to be understated, because yeah, Tyler's definitely, I agree with that, it, you know, takes time, and that it's really cool to see people come into their own apart from any other attachments. But I also just want to, you know, put out there that, you know, Tyler's definitely been, you know, one of those solid pieces of the foundation that has, you know, brought people together, and his creativity and is just through the roof. And so I'm very, very fortunate to have had the chance to connect with him, and in addition to my connection with the others. But yeah, even, you know, from like what, 10 plus years ago when we met until now, just being able to see how much I have grown in so many different ways, especially as an artist, and having had Tyler in a corner, you know, it's just like, wow. And that's not just for me, but for, you know, for many others as well. So I agree with everything Tyler said, but I also want to make sure that it's not understated. Because it's so important, and I'm grateful.
Can I make Tyler blush even more?
Yeah, go ahead.
his genius is caught on video. I saw that Lost in Translation.
Oh, yes.
Where you're making kick drum sounds from your acoustic guitar. You're sampling, yes, Charlie Parker. There's Theo's congos. You're flipping the pages of a book. You're reversing the sound of Antoine shushing. And I still haven't touched all the elements.
No, it's just the tip of the iceberg.
Just one song on this album. It's insane.
It's crazy. It really is. When he created that, I was like, oh my God, people need to see. He had recently made a comment because I think I'd done something and I was like, oh man, I screwed it up. And I made a comment to him, and he was like, you know, people are, you know, just, you know, they're interested in this or that. And I was like, oh no, people need to see this. And one of my favorite moments is when he's just like, you know, going through the pages. And I think that is shown in the Kickstarter video, but I'm sure a lot of people were just like, what the heck is he doing with that book? And so, so being able to see that, you know, the production demo, on the social media pages, you know, will open your eyes and ears, and you're like, oh, get the freak up out of here. That's what that was used for. You know, so yeah, Tyler is definitely a genie out of his bottle. So
yeah. Well, that's, you know, I'm actually kind of I'm surprised. And also like, it's cool to see that people actually like are somewhat interested in that part of the process. 'Cause you know, you never know. And I'm excited to share more because I do really feel like, you know, when I'm working on a song, it's like, man, you know, this is the whole thing just becomes a single stereo audio file. But there's so many layers underneath that when you just solo them sound really cool. And the only way you get to hear them is if you actually get to go inside the music and hear these things parsed out. And they're all little fun treats. You know, there's all this sort of fun, delicious little samplers like a charcuterie plate. You know, I'm a vegan, so I don't know if there's vegan charcuterie. But anyway, like, you know, a sampler plate of just sort of like a bunch of different little things that are great by themselves and don't need to necessarily be part of the whole entree all the time. So that video is, I'm encouraged. I'm like, oh yeah, I'll make more of those. Cause every song kind of has its own little world that you end up discovering and living in for a while. And it's fun to share it, you know? And it's fun to like, think about sounds and just like try to be creative about like what kind of sounds would bring the intention of this song to the most sort of three-dimensional experience possible. Emotionally, audio wise, all of it, you know.
Well, I'm going to urge all my listeners to check out the Kickstarter, check out your very, very thorough back catalog of music, and the track listing's great. I Antoine, was there any attempt to get Leanne LaHavas or Tower of Power on the record? Other than that, it's flawless, but I was hoping to see that.
Oh man, that is too funny, man. You've been digging in. I am so wow. Thank you so much, man. Yeah, those are, I mean, yeah, that those two there just kind of give you just a bit of a exploration or some insight into people that I love. You know, I love the old and the new, and I think in many ways, you know, this record kind of brings together, you know, some of those things with, you know, some of the things that, especially that Tyler has done production wise that you you know, may or may not recognize, that could be vintage or something like that. It's so crazy how so much is brought together with this particular record. But yeah, Leanne LaHavas, if you're listening, yeah, one day.
Oh man,
I would love to.
I would.
I guess fight, you know, with Tower Power. I mean, I'm just putting it out there. So
I would pay. No, I would pay so much money to hear an Antoine Leanne LaHavas collab. Wow. Oh God, man,
such a beautiful.
Yeah,
voice.
But wow. The two of you would be that would be phenomenal.
All right, when you two finally do a track, I invite you back onto the podcast. For sure.
Hey, man, we'll definitely take it.
Tyler, Antoine, it was an absolute pleasure to host you both, and I really do appreciate your time, and thank you for being here.
Oh, man.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you so much. This was great.